Welcome to Valhalla Conversations Podcast. I'm your host, Becky Hill, otherwise known as Soul Chaser Becky, and I am a proud Viking geek. I fell in love with the history, culture, and mythology of the Viking Age, and I have been on an endless quest for more ever since. Join me as I discuss all things Norse with those who have been inspired by Viking Age history and Norse mythology in their creative works, or those who have studied the sagas and archaeology, and review how such subjects are being presented to modern audiences today. If you like Viking stuff, you are welcome in my Valhalla, and I hope you stay for the conversation. Welcome everyone to Valhalla Conversations, my nerdy hall where I celebrate and talk about all things Norse, modern and historical and fantasy and everything in between. In episode 11, we're finally entering the double digits. I'm excited to welcome my latest guest, Joshua Gillingham. Welcome, Joshua.
Hello, hello. I'm so glad to be here. Thanks for having me on.
Would you like to introduce yourself and your many wonderful Nordic works?
I would indeed. Yes. So my name is Josh Gillingham. I'm an author and board game designer. I come from the northern realm of Canada. And yeah, I've loved Vikings for probably longer than I can remember. I do have some family connections to Norway and Sweden. And this sort of got me into the Norse myths, which led to the Icelandic sagas, and the rest, as they say, is history, literal history, and sometimes mythic history. My projects mostly focus on Vikings and the Norse myths in a fantasy setting. So my book series is called Tentree Saga, and it follows the exploits of a group of young troll hunters led by Torin Tentrees in the fantastical realm of Noros, where they are tasked with defending the realm from trolls. And if you read the series, all sorts of other things. It is a lot of fun. Other people's words, not mine, has very Hobbit-esque vibes. And so mm-hmm. You've got the fantasy realm, but it's not like Game of Thrones or anything like that. It's much more sort of Tolkien-esque fantasy, rife with riddles. So if you mm-hmm. love riddles, there's many riddles featured in each of the books. And the third book is actually set to come out soon. So I promise I will not pull a Patrick Rothfuss on you. You will get the third installment of the series. It will be finished. And I will not leave you waiting forever. I'm also the designer of Althingi One Will Rise, which is a card game set in historical Iceland around the height of the Viking Age. Every player takes on the role of a chieftain, and you get mm-hmm. to experience what it's like to step into that role and vie for power and influence amid a group of ruffian and cunning warrior Vikings. And so those were kind of my two main projects. I've had a few side projects associated with those, including an expansion to the Althingi One Will Rise card game, and a really exciting anthology, which was an exploration of the characters in the game's backstory, as imagined by a bunch of authors that we invited, most established in the historical fiction realm, which was really fun for me because I got to edit the book. And another thing that was birthed out of that project was one of the short stories known as Wave Runners, written by Caitlin Felix, mm-hmm. was actually then greenlighted to become a full novelization, which is also coming out this year and will be absolutely fantastic. I can guarantee you that because I also edited that book. And so I got a sneak peek at the full range, and Katie has just created this incredible story. I get all sorts of like behind the curtain peeks at things, but that's mostly me. So I write books, I design games, and they're mostly about Vikings. So.
Ah, well, you are definitely welcome in my humble little hall. And I am pleased to say, dear viewers and dear listeners, I have all his books, both the game and the expansion pack. I've played it with my nerdy friends when we go to Comic-Con. I have read his Gatewatch duo, yet to join the, have the third one join. And of course, Althingi, The Crescent and the Northern Star, is a wonderful collection of short stories depicting the many ways that the Norse might have met people of the Middle East and further. And of course, there's another book that I'm not sure if actually you might have skipped over, which was Old Norse for Modern Times, which yes. he edited with the wonderful Mr. Vikingverse himself, aka Ian Stewart Sharp, who we also have a connection with because both me and Josh have been on Mr. Stewart Sharp's Vikings and Valkyries real play TTRPG game based on his own TTRPG sourcebook, which Ian Stewart Sharp wrote. So I think kind of like if you're his protege for the amount of stuff that he's written compared to what you've written and edited as well. So yes, they're all wonderful. And I do highly recommend everyone go buy them, download them, play with them. Of course, the kind of games, we don't play books, you read books, but play games, of course. So I guess the first question that I ask a lot of my guests is, can you recall when or what first drew you into Viking culture, history, mythology, and all its various aspects?
Yeah, so I can point to a time. It was first year university. I was, you know, in that year of exploring myself and figuring out my identity and who am I in this world. The track that's been set out for me in grade school was, you know, had come to its end, and it was time for me to launch. And one of the questions I had was around family heritage. I just got suddenly this like urge to dive into family history that I'd never really had before. Neither of my parents were particularly interested in genealogy. There's always, you know, some family member who's obsessed with it and has stacks and stacks of stuff. And so I became that person and sort of dove into things. And one of the strongest family connections we have is to Norway. And so my great-grandma was from Norway, spoke Norwegian, and then moved to Northern Alberta to a town called Valhalla, which I was born very close to.
Wow.
In a nearby town called Beaver Lodge. So Beaver Lodge, the most Canadian sounding name of all time. And nearby is the farm where they grew up in, Valhalla Community Center. So the Scandinavian roots took me to the fourth floor of the university library, where I was at, to a dusty, apparently unused section of translated Scandinavian texts, which I literally had to like wipe a layer of dust off of. And I came across things like the Icelandic sagas, and I came across things like Kevin Crossley Holland's translation of the Norse myths. Yeah, and these just really got me amped. They drew me in. People always ask me why, and I don't know if I have a answer to that. It's a little bit like the physical mystery of gravity. It's like we feel its effects, but the physicists still like struggle to explain what it is exactly, right? So, but yeah, felt very drawn into it, and I didn't start creating right away. I really just for 2 or 3 years just absorbed everything I possibly could. To the point of me finding a few dilapidated copies that were falling apart and like begging the library staff to like let me just like buy them off of them so I could take care of them. They wouldn't fall apart, and they wouldn't let me buy them. But I found used versions of them other places. I'm thinking about the translation of Grettir the Strong. I found a copy of that.
Yes.
So I did secure my own personal copy, but yeah. And then I think at some point my brain was just so full of characters and myths and stories that it was going to explode, and it did, into what was eventually to become the Tendri saga books. And so, And so the Gatewatch, there it is. That's where
I'm holding it up for viewers listening on audio. It is beautiful. And I completely ditto Josh's statements earlier about it being Tolkien-esque. I think that's what I described as well in my own review when I reviewed them many years ago when I backpacked them, because they've been up for a while now, haven't they? Because they're maturing, I suppose.
They did. The first book came out just as the beginning of COVID struck. So my whole book tour was canceled and I had to rejig everything to online. But yeah, I'll always remember when it came out because it was like literally the first like month or two of lockdown, which is unfortunate. But thankfully, technology and shipping eventually has allowed many people to enjoy it. And yeah, the game thing sort of came in afterwards because I love board games, as I believe you love board games as well.
I do.
My original degree is actually also in mathematics, like pure mathematics. And so I have a very sort of also like number-oriented brain. And the myths plus my number-oriented brain really found a nice place to merge in game design, because you've got the narrative elements in game design of what the roles that the players step into, but then you've also got this like underlying mechanical structure, mathematical structure of what are the points and what are the strategies and is the game balanced? And those two things really drew me in. So people often look at me and say like, oh, all these random things that you do. But to me, it makes total sense. It's like Vikings and numbers and games and stories that could all just melt together. So,
I mean, I'm just impressed because A, the artwork that you got, the illustrations, they're just beautiful. They're not kind of insulting or diminutive or stereotypical, but they feel very realistic. And I quite like that. And it was a very fun game to play with my four friends when we used to, well, for the past few years I've been able to meet up with them for Comic Cons. This year I couldn't, well, as I did here last year, I couldn't because I was in Norway. So I'd already spent what money I would have spent on Comic Con in Norway. So there we go.
That's fun. Yeah.
but it is a lot of fun. All thingy, One Will Rise, I do recommend it. It's perfect for 3 to 4 players. And it's a nice introduction to what especially Viking life in Iceland is like, because not many people think of Iceland when they think Vikings, which is refreshing, I think. And it's a lovely card set. And so I guess, because I believe it was a Kickstarter, was it not?
It was indeed. Yes, it was. And I've run and feel blessed to have run 4 successful Kickstarters at this point in time. One of those with our good friend in common, Ian Stewart Sharp, who's the master of the Vikingverse. We ran the translation book. And then I also, crowdfunded the game, the expansion, and the anthology as well. So, crowdfunding, that's a wild ride. If you like the idea of strapping yourself to a rocket ship and then just lighting the fuse, and that's kind of the closest experience I could sort of compare it to. But what I wanted to do with the game was create like I don't want to be like academic about it, but I wanted to create a more authentically historical experience for board gamers, because there's tons of games I love. I love Blood Rage, which is a classic board game from Eric Lang, Canadian board game designer, as part of his sort of mythological series of games. There's like Champions of Midgard, there's Feast for Odin, lots of different ones, but none of them really to me like captured more like the cultural essence of being a Viking in a society where there is a lot of violence, and there is ritualized combat as a way to sort of settle disputes, but there's also this strong sense of like loyalty and giving gifts to your followers, and this sort of political undercurrent that especially in Iceland was present, because at the time of the game, at the height of the Viking Age, they did not have a strict kind of rigid monarchical structure. It was more not quite a democracy. Some people go a little far in terms of praising, how sort of equivalently modern Iceland was. It was its own culture in its own time, but it did have a much more equitable structure in terms of the landowners being able to have control of what was happening. Partly because it was so far off the map for Europe, a lot of people didn't care what was happening over there, and they could just do their own thing. But also because there was some really unique cultural elements of Norse society that lent itself to that happening. And as you know, and folks who are into Vikings might know, a lot of the customs, culture, and language from sort of the pre-Christian contact Norse societies was much better preserved for much longer in Iceland, mostly because of its geographical isolation. There's some political reasons for that too, but. Yeah, I didn't know how I was going to land. Sometimes you're nerdy and passionate about something and you put it out there and it's just crickets and nobody else seems to be excited about it. But I put this out there and there was just this appetite for a kind of a historically set, like guaranteed no horned helmets kind of thing, right? Viking game. And there was like you were an amazing support during that time. I know Saga Thing podcast was excited about it too. They pumped it up. I think I still have a picture of Andy said he took it when he went to Iceland. He was like playing it at Thingiveller, like in the actual national park.
Wow.
That just like made my day. But yeah, I was amazed and thrilled to see that there were so many people that wanted to see something like that too. You mentioned the arts. The art was done by Lada Shestova, who is an incredible artist to begin with, and is also a Viking reenactor. And so we had many conversations going back and forth. She had much more depth of knowledge in terms of the styles and the materials, but almost every artifact in the game and every piece of clothing is based on some either historical source or some material that was like known to be used by Vikings. And so you'll see a lot of the like the oval brooches on the women's dresses, and you'll see sort of the cuts of the men's jackets are based on sort of her reenacting experience, which I think brought a lot of historical depth to the game for people. So,
Well, that easily answers what my next question was, like, why pick Iceland of all places to model a Viking game on? So yeah, it's really insightful. And for those who kind of like been curious about how the game works, you basically become the Gothi, or the leader of a group from 4 quarters of Iceland. They've each got their bad points and good points, whether it's like where all the rebels live, or where the farmers live, or where the ship builders live. And then you have to recruit at this great gathering followers by offering them resources, whether it's gold arm rings or a bucket, depending on what cards are in your hand, so to speak. And then at the end of the day, because it follows like a clock of sorts, sort of morning and then afternoon, I think. It's been a while since I played it. But at the end of the afternoon in the play setting, you then have to pick which followers to fight against each other and see who wins. But your cards always get replenished to some degree at the following turn of the next day, depending, of course, on your geographical benefits or hindrances, depending. Because I know one of my friends who actually won that game, he was very, very clever with his strategy. Very, very clever. And I was like, I don't know what I'm doing. But it was fun. It's a learning curve, but it's a really good learning curve. And it it's informative, and I like how it, I recognize that sword handle from a museum somewhere, or it, yeah, it just feels, if not true, very, very plausible. Like, to quote the word, realistic, again, it just felt very realistic. And I really appreciated that aspect. Because I think I've only ever played one Viking-esque type of board game with some old D&D friends, and that was more kind of a resource gathering en masse. So you kind of like had to get all the fisheries and all the boat builders on board and fighting over who gets what resources and who has the most resources wins. I'm like, is that really what it was like? But it was, yeah, a fun idea. I can't remember what that was called. I've got a feeling it was either Midgard or Valhalla or some simplified name of that ilk. But yeah, so you did the book first, which was Gatewatch, and then was it Allthing? And then after Allthing, did you then return to Torrent Entrades and do the Everspring, which is book two?
So book two is the Everspring, yeah. And a funny story is that when I actually started writing this series, the Everspring was actually the book I started. And
really?
For about 4 years, I was really stuck on the intro. I wrote the first chapter again and again, and I'd drop it for a few months and come back to it. And what I realized was I was actually starting the story in the middle, and I had to start at the beginning. And so the first book, The Gatewatch, actually began as like a prologue for what was the Everspring, which is the book I was trying to write at the beginning. and it turned into its like its own full novel, and it stands on its own right, and I love it. It's still, I can go back and read it. It's a ton of fun. I have this interesting experience that I know a lot of authors have expressed, where if you write a book 4 or 5 years later, you come back to it and you know you wrote it, but you've done so much in between that, you know, it's a little bit foggy, and then you kind of get drawn back into the story. You're like, oh, like if you really think about it, you probably remember what happens next. But even the phrasing and the character surprise you with a joke every once in a while you forgot about, and it's fun to kind of relive the story as like almost like a like a new reader. So so the Everspring came out. The timeline of all this is very foggy because as I was talking about before the show, as we were just chatting here, publication is a very, very glacial industry in some ways, and it takes a lot to go from manuscript to, you know, final draft to publishing to shipping to, you know, being on your bookshelf. So while this was all happening, I'd written The Gatewatch. By the time The Gatewatch came out, I'd actually written the entire Everspring and submitted it, which was weird because I was excited about the Everspring. So I just finished it, but everybody else in the world was just being introduced to The Gatewatch. So I had to go back, read my book again, and just make sure I had all the details straight so I could like do book events and stuff like that too, which was fun. And then in that time, I also did that, writing the third book, which is forthcoming here soon. And so the game and the book kind of became, when stuff was slow for the book, I could work on the board game. And then when stuff got busy with the board game, I'd kind of take my foot off the wheel for the book a little bit. So it ended up working out kind of a nice rhythm that I could bounce back and forth. And it did kind of feel like I was using two sides of my brain, like maybe the more narrative side and maybe the more numerical side, if you want to think of it that way. So creatively, I just have this sort of like drive to create things. And it was nice to finally have a place to kind of funnel all that energy into. And the fact that these projects made it to print is an absolute miracle. I'm very grateful for everybody who contributed along the way, including editors and publishers and people who just gave good reviews and asked about the book and things like that and the game, because a lot of people are trying to publish books and a lot of people are trying to publish games. And in some ways, it's easier than ever with self-publishing to do that. But it's still, it's a long road. And the success that both the book and the game have had, I've just, yeah, feel really, really lucky that the Norns wove that nice little stitch into my story, because it's been a pleasure to put that out.
Yeah, I mean, I was just thinking then, like, when did I first come across the Gatewatch? Because I can't remember if I did or if you found me through various networks and said, hey, I have a book you might like, because I have been approached like that by many other people.
I think you were working, and I believe you're still associated with the Valkyries website, and I think that was initially I asked.
Sadly retired, unfortunately. The editor.
Oh, okay.
Yes, I know. Unfortunately, I think they retired about 2 years ago now.
Unfortunately. Okay. I do think that was our first point of contact, but yeah. And then from there, we've stayed in touch. Yeah. It's been awesome. So yeah, across the ocean, across the world. So
we were meant to be in the same episode together with Vikings and Valkyries, but the Norns twisted fate. So we're now one episode or two apart, but
they did
had a blast. And I'm still proud of how our characters did.
the Norns in my life at this point in time look very much like a 2.5-year-old girl that lives in my house. So yes.
I feel you. I have a 4-year-old.
yeah. You know what that's all about, right?
Also a girl, exactly, so. And they are a force to be reckoned with.
Yes.
I dread to think that I was like that when I was four.
there's an Icelandic term. It's not coming to my mind, but it translates to like a fire poker. It was a complimentary term of an Icelandic woman who was just like that. And so you wanted to raise a fire poker. So anyways, I'm sure it sounds more badass in Old Norse, but yeah, I like that. Sometimes I got a little fire poker on my hands here. So yeah.
Cool. Well, I was actually meaning to ask you kind of what Old Norse sources or influences, besides, of course, J.R.R. Tolkien himself having plundered Norse mythology for the same thing, did you feed in to your books, The Everspring and The Gatewatch?
It's really funny you say that, because I specifically, when I was writing the books, was trying to not do Tolkien. And as you correctly pointed out, Tolkien draws heavily on the Norse myths. And so in a sense, I think a lot of people view him as like a primary source for the Norse myths. And he really is like an excellent source, but he really is a secondary source. And a lot of his interpretations of especially things like elves and dwarves are much different than sort of the more like historically attested Norse cosmology. So part of what I was trying to do is actually kind of like return to more of the primary sources. But in doing that, because there's the same source material, I think people catch the essence of the Norse myths in both works. And so find them comparable, which, I mean, I could not be more pleased to, you know, be compared to Tolkien. That's the highest standard I could probably hold myself to as a fantasy author. But my original story for The Gatewatch, which was The Everspring, they kind of turned into this epic sort of trilogy, was I was just doing a retelling of the Norse myth, they are on a journey to go my brain here is in the coffee. So the Norse myth where Odin and some of his friends go on an adventure to Jotunheim, and they are encountering giants and doing all the things they do. And as the retelling sort of formed, I wanted to flesh out, I really enjoyed Kevin Crossley Holland's translation of the Norse myths. And as that story of Thor and Loki going to travel in Utgard starts to develop, and as I kind of started to fill in the details, it just sort of kind of grew legs of its own. And so the main characters, you know, is Thorin, is very similarly associated with Odin. So he's got like a sort of Odinic traits. Grimsa is a very like Thor-like character. He's like probably the most on par with one of the Norse myths. And then Brynn in the first novel is kind of like a Loki-esque character. And so the three characters that it just started as a simple retelling really started to grow from that. And so I think it retains a lot of elements of you know, Norse descriptions of the Viking world of Scandinavia at the time, but also their imaginations of what Jotunheim might look like, you know, this mountainous region full of giants and trolls and all sorts of other things. And so yeah, my intent at the beginning was just to kind of celebrate and kind of reimagine and reinvent and almost like reinvite folks to sort of like experience this magical realm that I had kind of discovered in these translated books that were collecting dust on the university shelf, and kind of invite them back into that world. And in doing so, I sort of created a world of my own, and I think it's been a portal and a gateway for folks to rediscover that too, and maybe see the Norse myths in a different light. So it's one of those things where I still get emails like every month or two from somebody in random places like Europe or the States or like overseas in Australia. And it's amazing to kind of see A, that, you know, the stories resonated with them, but B, there's something about, like I was saying at the beginning, there's something about the myths that just really draw you in. They're so fascinating. They're dark. They're, you know, these gods are not perfect beings, obviously, you know, they have a lot of flaws, but there's something that just keeps us coming back to these stories again and again. And that's what drew me in. And I think that's what has drawn readers to the series. And I hope it sort of continues the tradition of reinventing these and breathing kind of new life into them in different contexts so folks can continue to enjoy it.
Yeah, I mean, it's making me think back to the very first chapter or so in The Gatewatch, where Thorin and his best buddies are trudging up that mountain in the fog, and they meet dwarves, and they're the most unstereotypical dwarf-like dwarves you could ever come across, and yet they're so, it's refreshing, but it also feels familiar, because, of course, I'm familiar with most of the myths, not all of them, I couldn't quote them by any means, but I know dwarves kind of like they had their tricks and their things, and they, and of course they had, there's a bit of a riddle and an exchange of words, and Tony's friends get some gifts. I'm trying not to spoil it too much, dear viewers, but they get some gifts, but they're not what they think they are, and there's always a price to these things. And
yes,
it just shows that Loki wasn't the only trickster. There were, I mean, Odin's the biggest trickster of them all, because he makes everyone think he's not the trickster, which I think personally, but
yeah, totally.
But yeah, but I absolutely adored the books, adored the characters. I remember, I think I emailed you after I finished the Everspring for that ending. Oh my goodness, there's a lot of drama and tension building in the Everspring, but it was all absolutely enjoyable. And in fact, you're making me want to reread them now, just talking about them.
Just in time for the third book, right? Yeah.
Well, if you know the secret to reading time when you've got a 4 or 2.5 year old, do let me know.
I think it's coffee. That's what I got in my hand right now. That's what it's my meat of poetry, as it were. Yes.
that's the other thing. I absolutely fell in love with your feast hall scenes, both the food and the drink, and kind of like, I think it is in the Everspring, or maybe it would be at the end of the Gatewatch, where like have a big celebration for whatever reason and like bring out the most luxurious bottles of mead and people get drunk and do silly things. And it's just fun, absolute fun. And I can feel your enthusiasm and passion coming through all of it. And it was really, really wonderful. I suppose we should touch on Old Norse for modern times.
Yes, indeed. Let's
Everyone
do it.
Everyone should
Let's
have this on their bookshelf. I personally haven't quite used it because I know I absolutely butcher the pronunciation. I can't speak English fluently at the best of times. And how did that come about then?
Great question. So there's several accounts of a tradition in Norse culture where at the Yule feast, people would make boasts. And they would go around the room and everybody would boast about something that they were going to try to achieve that year. And of course, not to be outdone by the person next to you, these tended to sort of accelerate and get larger as you went around the circle and more ambitious. And so Harald Finnair is probably the most famous example of this, where he boasts that he will conquer all of Norway and he will not cut his hair until he does it to win the hand of the Danish king's daughter. And so in a similar fashion, Ian had this harebrained idea based on a book that he had of humorous Latin translations. So it was Latin for like things like slam dunk or like cowabunga dude, right? Like how you'd say that in Latin. And so he said, the world is missing, this kind of hilarity, but in Old Norse, and I think we'd be the ones to do it. And so none of us had a deep academic background, but obviously an interest. Both of us had studied the language. I've studied Norwegian and was somewhat fluent at one point in time. And so we drew on that a little bit, and we brought in Dr. Arngrimur Vidalin from University of Iceland, who helped us verify some of the translations and pronunciations. And then the esteemed Siobhan Clark, who hosts the Myths, Legends and Lore podcast, mm-hmm. narrated significant portions of the book for us too. So that was a lot of fun. It was neat because it was a bit of a collaborative effort on our part and on the part of the backers, because we had a bunch of phrases sort of planned out, but there was a chance for backers to also contribute phrases. And so it was neat to kind of just have some fun things translated. So you get like ranging from like, no, I am your father from Star Wars quote to, actual historical quotes from, Odin's sayings or Havamal some of the myths. So it was a neat project. It was pre-COVID, and I do feel like there's this like barrier in my brain. Anything that happened before COVID kind of seems like it happened in some distant imagined past, but it did happen, and it's an awesome book, and many copies have sold. So, and if you are interested in Ian stuff, I also encourage you, there's a whole literal universe called the Vikingverse that he's created, full of books and games and a fantastic RPG, which, as you mentioned, we had the chance to go and be featured on. So
yes, I second that call. Dear listeners and viewers, go to vikingverse.com, and I'm pleased to say that I will have Mr. Ian Stewart Sharp himself on the podcast.
Fantastic.
March. I've got him coming in March.
Nice,
that's when we've got the date penciled in. So yes, I'll be grilling him on this book and all his many other things, as well as his podcast, which we feature in. Please go listen to that. Vikings and Valkyries, go have fun. It's a wild ride. So I guess for you, because obviously book three is in the process of coming through, it's in the works, have you got anything else lined up? Or do you think you've just hit the peak of your mountain, so to speak?
That is a good question. I've always got something in the works. I probably have 4 games kind of in the background that I, you know, I've pitched to publishers and may one day see the light of day, we can hope. We'll see. That's always a bit of a shakeup. I designed games before All Thing and One Will Rise, and I've designed games since. And so it would be nice to get one of those out at some point. So I won't say too much more until I find a publisher for them, because I don't want to create any sense of false hope, as it's a bit of like watching sea turtles try to get out to the ocean there. But I have continued writing projects. I've recently been involved in a small press down in Victoria, which is close to where I live on Vancouver Island here in Canada. And it's run by Shannon Sin, who wrote a staggeringly successful book called The Haunting of the Haunting of the Northwest, I believe. It's about ghost stories from all around the Pacific Northwest, mostly focused on Canada. And so he started a press. He wanted to feature sort of folkloric horror fantasy type fiction from Western Canadian writers. And so I was invited to contribute to the first anthology called Black Cat. It's a very cool anthology if you are into folklore, witches, ghost stories. It's all fiction. It's all sort of locally set on the West Coast, which is neat. I was invited back to edit the second anthology. And it's called That Which Whispers, and it's a focus, same settings, so on the Pacific Northwest, but with a focus on witches and witch lore. And that was really neat to edit. I edited that alongside Zoe McKenna, who's an amazing author and also editor and reviewer. And I also am returning to the third anthology as a contributor again, and I've been working on a story that is, of course, Viking-themed and set in Valhalla National Park, or sorry, Valhalla Provincial Park, I should say, which is an actual provincial park in BC here. And so you have mountains like Odin's Peak and Gladsheim and things like that. So, So that'll be,
is there a lot of Nordic influence in Canada then? Because of course I don't know much about migration generally, so I've never known of anyone from the Scandinavian end going all the way to Canada. Of course everyone knows of people going over to the US, including us Brits. Yep, we put on a ship and went over there, but we never think much of Canada, I'm ashamed to say, for some strange unknown reason.
There's a lot of empty space up here, which unfortunately is can get a little bit lonely. But for the most part, we do enjoy our space. Yeah, there was a high volume of Scandinavian settlers. For example, my great grandparents who settled in northern Alberta. The prairies are very famous. It's sort of the middle section of Canada, fairly flat, very arable farmland. The prairies are famous for these like sort of pockets of cultural communities. So to this day, you'll find like German-speaking communities that speak German first and English second, or Russian communities, or French communities, or Polish communities, or Ukrainian communities. You really will find all different types across the prairies, which is it makes for a really cool cultural mosaic. But I would say to BC, you've been in Norway. You said you went to Norway last year. I've been in Norway. It's a beautiful country. It was neat to return. The west coast of Canada, and I've had friends from Norway visiting here saying the exact same thing. They've never been to a place that looks so much like Norway. The fjords are maybe a little bit steeper in Norway, but like the vibe, sort of the coastal aesthetic, sort of the ruggedness, the mountains, like, and the sea right close beside each other are very, very similar. And I think Scandinavian influence, you know, this is like a whole, probably another topic of conversation, but, you know, it's a mixed bag. You know, you get the good and the bad. I think in the UK, you struggle with a similar thing of like, it's often co-opted for, you know, nefarious purposes. But I really view my work as important in trying to reclaim the myths and set the narrative on a more constructive path, because I found it so personally rewarding to reconnect with my heritage. And it's just as a part of like building my self-identity and now my family culture, now that I have, you know, a daughter. That's been really neat. So I would say that there are historically many like towns named after Scandinavian places. Gimli in Manitoba holds an Icelandic festival that's very famous every year. That's kind of the center of like Icelandic culture, if you'd want to say in Canada, as far as I know. But really, yeah, sort of especially spread across the prairies, you get a lot of different Scandinavian communities. There is a new Scandinavian bakery that opened up near me, which I'm absolutely thrilled about. So I will pitch them as well, just in case somebody happens to be visiting Vancouver. They're called S'more Bakery and Cafe, and they're down in Saanich, which is another place in the island. Sydney, actually, I believe, right in the town of Sydney. And they're wonderful. So you don't see as much of the Scandinavian culture, I think, on the West Coast here as you do in the prairies. Mm-hmm. But it's still present. Yeah. Those Vikings, they like to travel, so.
They do. I mean, it's making me think back to the recently finished Vikings Valhalla series, which of course features Leif Erikson on his merry, merry, purely fictional travels
in
the wrong direction on the world before he finally learns out how to go west. I can't remember, is Lisanzo Meadows in Canada, or is that really the northern edge of the US? Because I can't picture it on the map in my head.
Yeah, Lonsdale Meadows is like the north tip of Newfoundland. Given my genealogical research, my family from the UK originally is Gillingham, that's where my name comes from, settled in Kings Point, which is also very close to Lonsdale Meadows. So it's sort of the north tip of Newfoundland Labrador, which is the furthest east province. And actually, Newfoundland is an island off of the coast of Canada and is a part of Canada. So, yeah. Yeah. So there's that very celebrated Viking connection. There's many claims of Viking finds in the States, but none have ever been archaeologically verified. There are attestations in the sagas about Vinland, which most likely, you know, land of wine or rich land refers to North America. So there may have been landings more on the mainland, but Lonsdale Meadows is the only archaeological archaeologically confirmed site that that Vikings were at. So, yeah.
It's the biggest joke I think the Vikings ever pulled, calling Iceland... No, Greenland, when it's mostly ice and snow. Iceland is variable. And of course, Vinland, when they found supposedly great. But I never know whether that's actually in the sagas or if it's just an urban myth that's just been passed down ever since. But it has been wonderful talking to you about all this. I could carry on, but I know you've got a job and I need to get to bed because we're in different time zones entirely. So I'm taking precious time out of your working day, but I really appreciate you joining in my humble hall of Valhalla conversations. And if anything, I would like to get you definitely in future for when book 3 does come out in the world.
I would love
to talk about all 3 books and then I can speak about all the spoilers. And if anything, I will read them both before book 3 comes out, definitely. But I wish you best of luck with whatever adventures you're doing next, whether they're Norse or not. And thank you again very much for your time.
Becky, I so appreciate you having me on. Tusen takk, as they say in Norway. And I look forward to chatting again soon. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much for listening to this episode. I hope you enjoyed the discussions between my special guests and myself. Please do check out the episode blurb for links to their works and websites. If you liked this episode, let me know by giving it a thumbs up. Let me know if you learned something new in the comments. And of course, click subscribe to Valhalla Conversations wherever you are listening or watching. This podcast can be watched on YouTube and YouTube Music. And it can also be listened to on Spotify, Amazon Music, Podcast Index, and on RSS.com. We hope you can join us in Valhalla again soon for more conversations.